Before we begin, let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation and think that we will listen and share together this morning so that we can learn about wisdom and compassion, and through learning about those, be able to cultivate them in our own mind streams, and by cultivating them in ourselves, may we become of greater and greater benefit to each and every living being. And so our ultimate aim is to benefit all living beings, and to do that we have to purify our mind and enrich our good qualities limitlessly, so that what we do will actually be helpful to other living beings in the long term. So even though we're doing something just for an hour or so right now, may we have this very long term and grand motivation to be of benefit to each and every living being. So take a moment and make that your intention for being here today. Slowly open your eyes and come out of your meditation. So, there's many levels of Tibetan Buddhist practice and Tibetan yoga. And some of them are very, very advanced. I'm not at that level yet. I'm still very much a beginner. I think it takes many lifetimes to complete the path. So being a beginner for some time is not so bad. I'm not familiar with your tradition, so excuse me if I say anything that doesn't fit. But I wanted to share a little bit about, I was asked to share a little bit about my meditation, my practice. So the first thing, of course, that came into my mind was the thing that my teachers themselves emphasize over and over and over again, which is our motivation for doing our practice, our intention. And I remember when I first encountered Buddhism, I had no idea of looking at my intentions for things too much. An idea popped in my mind and I did it, I followed it. And what I came to see through my own meditation practice was that all of my intentions are not necessarily so good. Yeah? Some of my intentions are supported by clinging attachment. I want something for myself. I'm exaggerating the value or the happiness that something could give me, and so I'm clinging on to it and saying, I want this, I need it. And of course, the more we have attachment, whether it's to a physical object or even to a person or to an idea, yeah, or to a situation, we can be attached to many things. But the more we're attached to something, the more angry we get when our desires are impeded. something that we're sure is going to bring us happiness, and then circumstances prevent us from getting it, or another person intervenes, or something happens, and so we get angry. And then, when nothing special is happening in our life, we're often just in this state of kind of ignorance, confusion. You know, we're not wide awake and alert and mindful of our intentions at all. We're just kind of, well, you know what I mean. So here we have throughout the day these three major afflictions. Yeah, ignorance, so just kind of, well, spacing out, so to speak, then getting attached to things because we've exaggerated their good qualities, and then getting angry at things that impede us from getting what we want. And that anger is also based on exaggerating the negative qualities of someone or something. And so all day long, we were basically going up and down, up and down, up and down in terms of our thoughts. I want this, I can't stand it. Give me this, get me away from this. Yeah. And so most of our life is taken up that way. And even when we try and practice a spiritual path, we have so many imprints of ignorance, anger, and attachment that they come with us into our spiritual practice. Or at least they have with mine. So attachment comes in. Oh, I want to sit in perfect Vajra position. Then everybody will look at me and say, look what a good meditator she is. She must be a holy being. Yeah. So attachment to reputation, attachment to image, to receiving praise and nice words from other people. Then anger, or better yet, worse yet, actually jealousy. Oh, that person sits in meditation better than I do. Oh, everybody respects them. Everybody thinks that person is really advanced on the path. They don't see me like that. I'm jealous because I know that person well, and really, they don't know anything. Well, maybe a little bit, but I know more. And jealousy comes right into our spiritual path, and we begin to compete with our fellow practitioners. So instead of really supporting each other and helping each other and rejoicing at each other's practice, we compete to see who's better, who gets the most recognition. Then maybe we get sick and we can't practice, and we get angry. Yeah. What made me sick? Oh, somebody had a cold, or somebody didn't wash the dishes well, and now I'm sick and I can't practice. Yeah. Or somebody's making noise around us when we're trying to meditate. Yeah. You know that one? Yeah. You're trying to meditate. And the dogs decide it's time to hold their doggy conference, and they all bark and howl at the same time, right when we're trying to meditate, right? We get so angry at those dogs. And then the dogs are quiet, and somebody's playing the radio. Oh, don't they know we're here in a quiet space? Why are they bothering me playing the radio? And such awful music. Yeah? So here it is, right in the middle of our spiritual practice. And, you know, what we call the three poisons, ignorance, anger, and attachment, are right there. Yeah. Well, I just described attachment and anger. Ignorance comes comes up, we finally sit down to practice. It's quiet around us. And what do? You know that one? Yeah. You've slept very well the previous night. It's not shortage of speech, of sleep. But you try and do something serious with your mind. And then you start working at overcoming those things, the ignorance, anger, and attachment. And, you know, maybe you start developing some concentration, you know, your mind is clearer and more peaceful. Then you get really attached to your Dharma practice, to your meditation practice. Oh, I'm gaining concentration. This is so peaceful. Yeah? It's not liberation, but at that point we get so attached to the peace of meditation that we forget about liberating ourselves from the cycle of existence. And we just want to stay in our blissful meditation. Then we kind of realize that's not going to take us anywhere good, because we're still going to be under the, you know, influence of ignorance and karma ultimately. And so we say, okay, I want liberation. But our thought is always, my liberation. I'm going to get liberated from samsara. I want to attain moksha, nirvana. I want to be liberated, you know. And so what do we have here? My liberation, my nirvana, is more important than everybody else's nirvana. I want to attain moksha. Well, I hope everybody else does too, but basically, I don't care so much about them. My aim is my liberation. I wish them well. Yeah, I have compassion for them, those poor people. But I'm going for my own liberation. Okay, so what do we have there? Selfishness. Don't we? Yeah, the self-centered mind. Right in the middle of our highest aspiration is self-centered mind, my liberation. Forget about everybody else. And so then we really need to step back and say, well, is that right to just work for my liberation? Because actually, when we look at our lives, we're the recipients of a tremendous amount of kindness from other living beings. Everything we have is due to the kindness and efforts of other living beings. Right now we're sitting here in this room. How did this room come about? We have the name of the founder of the center. She had the idea to do this.
Maniji.
Yeah? And she had the idea. But it wasn't only her that built it. You needed all the people all the donors who contributed. Then you needed the architect and the landscaper. And you needed all the workers. All the workers who poured concrete, who laid bricks, who cleared the land, who put up the roof, who put in the electricity and the plumbing. You know, all those people who worked often in the hot sun for hours on end for very little money. And they worked hard, and as a result of their efforts, we have this room to use. Yeah. Do we even noble those people are to go and say thank you. We have no idea. We all ate breakfast this morning. How many people were involved in growing the food and transporting it and cooking it and serving it and cleaning up? Do we thank the cooks and the dishwashers? Or the people even who are sweeping the paths around here? We often just take these people for granted, and yet our ability to follow a spiritual practice is due to their kindness. Then we look, you know, in our whole life, and beside the kindness of our parents, the kindness of our teachers, everybody who taught us when we were little. Which sometimes were our parents. After all, our parents taught us how to speak, mostly. Our family taught us how to speak. School teachers taught us how to read and write. We may have done years and years in education and have many talents and abilities, but all of these came through the kindness of people who taught us and encouraged us. None of it came from ourselves alone. So when we look at things that way, then does it seem right to just think about my moksha, my nirvana? It doesn't seem right at all, does it? Because our whole life, just even staying alive, depends on others. Everything we know, everything we're able to do, depends on others. Just seeking our own spiritual liberation doesn't seem right at all. Yeah. Because we're totally related, enmeshed in this web of life where we all influence each other. And so then again, our motivation, our intention has to change. And instead of just seeking my liberation, we have to say, my liberation so I can benefit others. And not just benefit them a little bit, giving them some biscuits or something, but, you know, may I attain the highest levels of spiritual practice. In my tradition, we call it enlightenment, or to become a Tathagata, a Buddha. We think, may I attain that state? Not so that I can go around saying, oh, well, I'm fully awakened. But so that I'll have all the qualities and abilities necessary to really be of the greatest benefit to other living beings. Now, isn't that what the real intention of my spiritual practice should be? And not just the real intention of my spiritual practice, but the real intention of my whole life. Because shouldn't our life be our spiritual practice, and our spiritual practice be our life? In other words, we don't just come for a yoga retreat and we're spiritual for a couple of weeks and then we go home and, you know, back to our old habits. That's not going to help us so much. Yeah. So everything we learn, whatever new habits we start during a retreat, we need to take home with us and really implement in our daily life. So that our whole practice becomes, or our whole life becomes our practice. And the first stage in doing that, yeah, which again and again I see is so important, is developing proper ethical conduct. Yeah. Now, of course, our parents taught us ethical conduct when we were little. They taught us don't lie, don't steal, don't harm living beings, don't talk behind people's back, You know, our parents taught us to be good people. But I don't know about you, when my mental afflictions rise very strongly, when there's strong anger or greed or selfishness, then my ethical principles get renegotiated. Yeah. Often in my favor. So, for example, when I see politicians or business people lie or cheat, I think it's disgusting and horrible. But when I want to lie, there's a good reason for it. I can rationalize my own lie. Or if I cheat somebody a little bit, it's just a little bit. It's not a big corruption. It's just a little corruption. Well, no, it's not really a corruption because I'm not corrupt. Those business people who own the big corporations and Wall Street and like that, they're corrupt. But me, oh me. Okay? So I see that actually keeping good ethical conduct is not so easy. Because our mind always thinks of self-centered reasons that seem like really good reasons why we should do what our afflictions want. But again and again, what I witness is when I follow that mind, I wind up in trouble, spiritually and with other people. And when I look around me and watch other people, ordinary people, but especially spiritual practitioners, when I see them lose some of, their ethical conduct, things really collapse around them. So I'm not somebody to judge others, but what I can do is look at others' experience and say, I need to learn from their experience so that I don't make the same mistake. Yeah? Because the thing is, if we keep good ethical conduct, other people will trust us. If we don't, do that, if we're cheating other people of their stuff and talking about them behind their back and criticizing them to their face and lying to them or lying about them, then, they're not going to trust us. And if people don't trust us, how can we have good relationships with them? Difficult. And also, if we don't act according to our own values and principles, then we don't have a good relationship with our own self. In our own heart, we don't feel very good. I don't know about you, but when I've done things that, or said things that I don't feel very happy about, and there's like inside, there's this incredible feeling of discomfort. It's like, okay, I've got to do some purification. I've got to make amends about this. I don't know how people like the dear president to be of my country, how he goes to sleep at night after doing what he does all day. If I treated other people like that or spoke to other people the way Trump does, I would not be able to fall asleep at night. And at the end of the day, how our relationship with ourselves is what's really important, not what other people think of us. So at the end of the day, it's not our name, it's not our fame, it's not how many people cry when we die, yeah, is our own relationship with ourselves that is really going to matter, because at the time of death, what comes with us is the karma that we've created during our life, the actions that we've done, whether they be virtuous or non-virtuous. And also the imprints from our spiritual practice. Those come with us too. Hopefully they've been virtuous. And if we have, you know, a lot of virtuous seeds and imprints and latencies in our mind, then when it's time to die, we have no regret. We'll be able to look back on our life and say, I did something useful with this life. I solved more problems than I created. I was able to give some kindness to other people and brighten their lives in some way. Otherwise, you know, we die and people, you know, so many people have regret. And yet, what is it people regret when they die? I've never heard anybody die saying, I should have worked more overtime. What do people regret? Not having been kind. Or having been deceptive. Having taken advantage of others. Not having treated other people well. Not having expressed their affection and high regard for the people in their lives. So rather than dying with regret, which I don't think any of us want to do, then while we're alive, you know, moment to moment, day to day, to try and keep our minds in a virtuous state and express our affection to others, you know, through maintaining good ethical conduct with respect to them. And, you know, really any virtue that we manage to create in our lives, to dedicate that for the welfare of all beings, not just our own welfare or our own liberation. But even we make an offering, we do bowing, we do meditation. In our mind, to have a good intention before we do it, and then after we do it, to dedicate it for the well-being and the spiritual awakening of each and every sentient. And in that way, you know, everything we do becomes directed towards awakening, towards being of great benefit. Yeah. So there's one practice that I do every morning that helps me to live like that and to remember that intention. And so when I wake up, I think, today, I'm not, as much as possible, I'm not going to harm anybody else. And that's the most important thing I have to do today. Not going here, not going there, not doing this or doing that. Yeah, I'll do all those different actions. But when I'm doing them, the most important thing is not to harm anybody. So not to harm physically, yeah, not to harm verbally through how we talk to others or about others, and to avoid harm mentally by letting our mind dwell in unkind thoughts, or thoughts of revenge or malice or something like that. And then the second thing I think every morning is, in addition to not harming, I want to be as helpful as I can to others, as kind as I can to others. Yeah. So whether it's some insect that's drowning in a bucket of water and I take it out, or some snail along the path that somebody's going to get stepped on, that somebody's going to step on, so I move them out of the path, or, you know, whoever it is that's right in front of me at any particular time, may I be of benefit, that service to that person, in whatever big or small way I can. And then the third part of my daily meditation is, you know, to keep this mind aspiring for full awakening, for full Buddhahood, or to become a Tathagata myself, to keep that as my ultimate long-term aim in life, and to always hold that in mind at some level of my mind and not let myself stray from that ultimate purpose. So I set that motivation first thing in the morning. Of course, I'm not a perfect being. I make many mistakes during the day. But I try and remember that motivation throughout the day, and I try and observe my actions. Yeah, some days I do better than others. Some days I'm really not so good. Yeah, and so later on in the day, in the late afternoon or evening, I try and do some review, and if there's something that feels uncomfortable in me, then I know, okay, I didn't act according to my own motivation today. I have to look at that situation. Yeah. Maybe I was condescending to somebody, or disrespectful, or angry, or judgmental, or who knows what. On different days it's different things, but to look at that in the evening and try and correct my attitude. Yeah. So if there's a clinging attachment, to let that go and enjoy just the peace of not clinging to things in this life, or at least reduce clinging to things in this life. Now, or if I'm angry, to spend some time thinking of the kindness of others and thinking how they want to be happy and not suffer just like I do. You know, so that I can release the anger. Yeah, and then when there's self-centeredness, to really come back and say, that's not going to work. Being self-centered about my spiritual practice is not the kind of person I want to be. So doing this kind of thing every day, and, you know, every morning generating our motivation and our intention, every evening, you know, looking back over the day and seeing how we did and correcting things when we made a mistake. And when we did well, congratulating ourselves. We have to learn to rejoice in our own virtue. Yeah. Not be proud of it. Pride is an affliction. But we can definitely rejoice in it and rejoice in our own virtue, rejoice in the virtue of everybody around us and of all the holy beings of all the different traditions. And then dedicate all of that for the awakening of each and every living being. So in this way, we kind of have a grounded practice, you know? Something in the morning, in the middle of the day, in the evening. And then we can also go to sleep with a calm mind and wake up with a calm mind. Now, if we go to bed angry, usually our sleep or our dreams, our angry dreams, and we wake up angry. Yeah. And then, I don't know about you, but when I wake up angry, if I don't instantly do something with my mind, I'm not so nice to be around that day. just a little bit, you know, kind of an introduction, but also it's encompassing the whole thing, you know, talking about our intention, our motivation, why that is so important, and how to integrate it in our daily life. So now maybe you have some questions or specific things you want me to discuss.
He's asking how much hours it will take for enlightenment.
You mean
by
what?
For enlightenment.
How many hours will it take?
How many days?
Yeah, it's going to take a while to obtain enlightenment. When you think, you know, that we've been in samsara, in psychic existence, since beginningless time, we have a lot of deep-seated habits we need to overcome. So in my tradition, they always say, aspire for enlightenment.
You are telling how many lifetimes was the answer for that. But what I always feel is maybe any moment it can happen. Maybe this, or maybe after lifetimes or something like that. Lifetimes, there is no limit also. And it can happen at any moment. That's what I always feel.
Okay. You know, we're all very different. And we all have our own feelings and thoughts and intuitions about things. In my tradition, they say, aspire to attain awakening in this lifetime, but don't expect to. Okay? And
can you say about Buddha?
Yeah, well, the same thing with Buddha. It wasn't that he just started practicing in that lifetime when he was born, Siddhartha Gautama. He practiced many, many, many lifetimes before that. Yeah? So, yeah. But for me, when I attain awakening is not, I don't fret over that. I'm more concerned with creating the causes for awakening. Because if you create the causes, the result will come. And you don't have to worry about the result coming. Yeah. If you plant a seed in the ground and you give it enough water and fertilizer and it's as this hot season, the seed's going to grow. You don't need to dig it up every day and say, when are you going to sprout? You know, the causes and conditions are there. So I regard my spiritual practice the same way. I'm just creating causes. When awakening comes, it'll come. Yeah. So that kind of attitude just keeps me focused on what I'm doing in the present instead of dreaming about, I'm going to get something special and I'm waiting for the big zap to happen.
How did you came into this path? Can we know about
how did I come into this path? Well, it was not how I was raised and not what my parents expected me to do. As a young person, I always had a lot of spiritual questions. I was asking, why am I alive? And what's the purpose of my life? And I went to different religious leaders in the West, and the people that I met, couldn't, you know, give me an answer that really satisfied me. It all kind of came down to, Well, it's a mystery, so just have faith. But that approach may work for some people, but it doesn't work for me. Because I need to understand. Yeah, and I need to be able to think about things and examine them and investigate them and determine for myself that they're true. I first encountered Buddhism, I saw a flyer in a bookstore in Los Angeles. I had been to India before. Yeah, I had been to Nepal and seen, you know, Buddha start and everything. And I was attracted to it, but nothing happened. It was only after I returned to the U.S. and I saw this flyer about a meditation retreat. And I was a teacher at that time, so I had summer vacation off. So I thought, let's go. So I went, and there were two Tibetan lamas teaching it. One of the first things they said was, you don't have to believe anything we tell you. And I thought, oh, that's good. You know? They said, you're intelligent people, you think about things. Yeah. See if they make sense to you. Test them out and see if they work. Then you use your own wisdom to decide. So that's what I did. And the more I studied, the more I practiced, I really gained some conviction that, yes, this path that the Buddha taught is really true. Yeah. That, you know, there is a continuity of consciousness. That our basic, the basic nature of the mind is pure and untainted. That what makes me unhappy is not other people, but my own ignorance, anger, and attachment. They're the source of my misery. And so, you know, the more I practiced, the more this made sense to me. And so I quit my job as a teacher. And in those days, this was 1975, there weren't very many Buddhist centers in the U.S. where English was the major language. And so in order to learn, I had to come back to this part of the world, which I'm very glad I did. And so I spent many years between Nepal and India, especially in Dharamsala, where the Tibetan community in exile is centralized. And, you know, in the process of all that, I decided I wanted to ordain and become a nun. My parents didn't like the idea. That's putting it mildly. But for me, when I really looked at my motivation and when I really thought about, you know, what am I going to do with my life and what's really important to me, I felt, you know, I have to live according to my heart, according to what I feel is really strongly, what needs to be done. Yeah. So, you know, I requested ordination and then kept studying under the same teachers that were the first teachers I met. And of course, they also introduced me to other Buddhist teachers who I've trained under also over the years.
So in India, if we want to practice Tibetan meditation, how can we practice?
If you want to do it here, yeah, there's many places, you know, in Dharamsala. There's the Library of Tibetan Archives, there's Tushita Meditation Center. In Delhi, there's at Tibet House, one of the monks.
In Kushal Nagar, I have been to Kushal Nagar near Mysore.
Okay, near Kushal Nagar. I'm not sure. You know, you have to look around. I mean, certainly.
Do you know any places in India?
Any what?
To Dharamsala, you say, we can go and practice over there?
In Dharamsala, in Bir, in Dehradun, there's places in Delhi. there's some major monasteries just in outside of Hubli. That's where we're going. Finding a teacher there, you may have to find one and negotiate and so on. But amidst, you know, within the Tibetan refugee community in India, there's a lot of excellent teachers here. And I really have to thank the Indian country and the Indian government, especially Nehru, for, you know, letting the Tibetans come in 1959, when they had to flee their own country after an abortive uprising against China, the Chinese communists. And, you know, the Indians so very kindly opened their doors to tens of thousands of refugees coming in and gave them land. Some of the land was jungle. The monasteries outside Hubli, you know, it was jungle when they went in.
Yeah, yeah, I have been there. That's why I'm asking. In Hubli they are practicing?
I don't think so much in Hubli, but
they don't teach.
In Mungot. Yeah, in Mungot, in Bailakupi. But you have to find a teacher and request teachings yourself. Actually, in Bangalore, there is a Dharma center that is really good, and they have regular teachings there. It's called
Chokor Sumling.
Yeah.
Can you be here?
Yeah. In fact, my first teacher is going to be there teaching.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Lama Zopa
Rinpoche is coming.
He's coming tomorrow and then teaching starts.
And teaching begins from the 6th. I have it on my phone.
Yeah. Can you suggest any small meditation technique like that?
Sure. Yeah, you can do a short meditation.
Yeah, it's really nice to have a meditation from you.
Okay. So, let's come back to our breath. Let our mind relax. And then I'll lead you in a guided meditation about the kindness of others. Yeah. Okay, so first come back to your breath. And begin by reflecting that once you were a very helpless baby, you couldn't feed yourself or care for yourself in any way, but other people cared for you. They kept you alive. They fed you. They protected you from danger. To reflect on that kindness that you've received, probably from parents and family, but it could be from other people who took care of you when you were totally unable to take care of yourself as a baby. And recall that we've had many previous lives, and in most of them we've had people and parents So if we have a feeling of beginningless lifetimes, then all other living beings at one time or another have been our parents, have been our family members, and have taken care of us with the same love and affection and dedication as people this lifetime have taken care of us when we were infants and toddlers. So get a sense of that, broaden that feeling of having received kindness in this life. Broaden that to include all living beings when they were your parents or whoever took care of you when you were little. Reflect on all the teachers you've had in this life. People who taught you things, how to speak, how to read and write, how to drive, how to do whatever skill or occupation you have. How many people not only taught you and directed you in learning, but encouraged you and told you, yes, you can do that. So think about those people and really get a feeling of their kindness and how much you've benefited from it. And then think you've had beginningless lifetimes, and in those lifetimes, all living beings, at one time or another, have been your teachers who taught you with that kind of kindness and affection and patience. And so feel the kindness of all living beings, reflecting that the kindness we've received isn't just in this life, it's also in previous lives. Thank you. things you have and use on a daily basis, buildings and buses, cars, roads, food, clothing, medicine, everything around us that we use and to stay alive and to help us learn, and reflect that all of this came about due to the efforts of other living beings. People who grew the fruit, food, and harvested it, transported it, prepared it, cleaned up. And really think how many people are involved with us eating one meal or sitting in one building. And really, again, feel the kindness of all those people whose efforts you have benefited from. And really see how there's no way we could stay alive without the efforts of other living beings, without their kindness. I recall that in previous lifetimes also, you've had that kind of relationship with others, whereby they've been the ones in society who've done whatever job they do, preparing food, shelter, medicine, education, housing, all those things that we depend on to stay alive. Again, feel the kindness, the interrelatedness, the way that you've received benefit from all living beings. From contemplating in this way, let a feeling of gratitude arise in your heart, acknowledging that you've been the recipient of tremendous kindness and feeling grateful for it. And together with that feeling of gratitude, have an aspiration to repay that kindness to others, to all living beings. arise and come out of your meditation. Feel different? Is there some change in your mind? I think this is a quite nice meditation to do regularly, because it really helps us feel in sync with everybody else around us. Yeah. And that helps us not make such a big deal out of things that we don't like, but to really appreciate the goodness in everybody.
Particular time of the day to practice this meditation? Particular time of
the day? Particular time?
Time. Just whenever you have time. Yeah. Usually they say morning is the best time for meditation, because our mind is fresh in the morning. But sometimes people prefer their evening, people they prefer the evening or some other time of day. Okay. So I think we'll have to draw to a close now. I just want to chant a dedication because I've spoken about, you know, we started with a good motivation and then finishing with sharing the merit, dedicating it to the awakening of all beings. So really rejoice at what you're doing here in your yoga course. Rejoice at what you've learned, how much your mind has transformed into virtue because of it. Rejoice at the virtue that your fellow students have created as well, that all of us have created doing what we're doing together. And rejoice in all the goodness in the world. And then let's dedicate that towards the ultimate full awakening of each and every living being. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious bone divine, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.